Good afternoon. It is 12:02 here on WASR. Let's try again. Now it's 12:02 on WASR. Hello there. It's Eric Scott Friday, and you know what that means. That means it's Senator Jeb Bradley is with us. Senator, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I am well, doing pretty well. It's a absolutely beautiful day. You really couldn't ask for anything more. You going to go out this weekend, or is the gardening taking care of?
Going to go tomorrow to Conway, North Conway, actually, for the dedication of a new fire station, which it's next to the train station. It's actually a beautiful building in keeping with the architecture of the train station in Conway, which is really rather unique and a monument. The fire station is pretty cool. And Governor Sununu's going to be there, and Councilor Kenny, myself, a lot of other people. I think it's something that folks in North Conway have justifiable right to be very proud of.
Yeah, it's an awful lot of high-powered people going to be there. What time is the festivities?
Starts at 10.
10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sounds like fun, actually.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
All right. So, anything interesting happened to you in the Senate this week? As far as out of the ordinary,
there's a big debate on bill that would have created a 2-mile buffer for creation of any new landfill around a state park. And there was quite a debate about that. And, it's one of those bills that you sort of don't like whatever happens. And I voted against it. So let me start out by saying that. So on paper, you think, oh, okay, a 2-mile buffer is a good idea. Protect state parks. And I would agree with that. And it's as a result of a current application or potential application, I should say, by a waste management company to build another landfill in Dalton, New Hampshire, that would be fairly close to Forest Lake State Park. So,
do you know what the existing limit is?
I think it's to within the property boundaries, and then there's a setback within, the siting regulations of several hundred feet is okay. My understanding. However, and this gets to one of the reasons why I did not vote for it, the Department of Environmental Services has broad latitude when permitting a landfill facility to establish environmental protection criteria that would protect, neighborhoods, property values, to say nothing of, groundwater, air emissions, things like that. It's a very rigorous, scientifically based environmental process. And I don't know in, this particular application if it's even permittable, given its proximity to Forest Lake, and whether it's even permittable under Dalton zoning. And so, I felt like the Department of Environmental Services would do a good job in looking at the particulars of this, and that an arbitrary 2-mile buffer that applied only to state parks, it didn't apply to, any other conservation areas or bodies of water or the White Mountain National Forest or, the Wildlife Refuge in Newington or any number of, other types of, land preservation initiatives that we have in New Hampshire. So that kind of was a bit of an issue for me. The other issue, and I think it's a bigger issue, is that, nobody wants a landfill, but when, as individuals, as businesses, as organizations, whatever, do we not have trash? And that is, a fact of life that unfortunately is not going away. And we have several towns still have landfills. Obviously, Wolfboro's has turned into a, you know, waste, what's the right word? It's not just a recycling facility, but a transfer facility. And I'm not sure where Wolfboro's waste goes to, whether it's one of the two North Country landfills or turnkey. But situation in terms of capacity in New Hampshire, the two North Country landfills are permitted through 2025 and 2020, respectively. So a relatively short time frame. Turnkey, I believe, is permitted through either 2033 or 34. So a little bit longer time frame. What else is happening in New Hampshire that concerns me is with changes in the international recycling market, i.e. China not accepting as much material for recycling, the cost of recycling has gone up substantially. And so most recyclables now in New Hampshire are being processed in Billerica, Massachusetts. So because of the high transportation costs, a lot of communities have curtailed their recycling or ended it totally and are just landfilling what normally would be recyclables because of the additional cost of sending things out of state. Mm-hmm. And anybody that used the Wolfboro transfer station over the last year and a half, they just started accepting plastics again, you know, for recycling. So for a long time, plastic bottles, milk containers, on and on, were just being landfilled. And, you know, to me, that is really problematic. But it comes back to cost of, you know, why that happened. And if you're transporting everything out of state, because we're one of the two states in the country that do not have a what's called a materials recovery facility, it just undermines the ability to recycle. And we have a goal in New Hampshire of 40% waste reduction through recycling and reuse. And so here we are. With diminishing landfill capacity, no recycling facility that processes recyclable goods in the state, and towns ending recycling. So that there's an environmental cost on the other side. And so the one application that, you know, had everybody upset in Dalton near the state park, part of that application is to build one of these recovery facilities, probably in Manchester or possibly Nashua, that would have just totally changed how we recycle and made it far better. And the trucks that are transporting recyclables from New Hampshire to Massachusetts, getting them off the road has a big environmental benefit, too. So this is one of those, you know, you're darned if you do, you're darned if you don't, you know, type of situations. And, you know, clearly we need capacity, and passage of that bill, I think, would have undermined the ability to ever build a new facility. Whether or not that one that's, you know, being proposed is permittable, I don't know. I think it's 50-50 shot at best, given the parameters and the proximity to the lake and some of the other, you know, issues involved in any landfill. Whether it could be permitted anyway is an open question, but to create a law with that kind of a buffer around every state park, I think precludes the ability to, you know, have more permitted landfills in New Hampshire. And quite frankly, any new landfill in New Hampshire, whether it's this one in Dalton or if that one fails, in order to get a permit, they have to show, the applicant has to show a public benefit test. And that test, I absolutely believe, especially given that the applicant in Dalton has said they would build a recycling facility in Manchester as part of their public benefit test. There will not be another landfill in New Hampshire that gets permitted unless it builds, you know, one of these facilities that would enhance recycling. So I hope I haven't, you know, bored you to death with, you know, this one, because it's very complicated, but it really boils down to, you know, we all generate trash, and, you know, especially as towns, because of cost pressures, have curtailed recycling, there's an environmental impact for not trying to enhance that capacity and get a recycling facility in New Hampshire. So,
is it
the bill
time?
Died. I think it was a 14 to 8 vote. There were two people missing, although if those two people had been there, it would have been a 16 to 8 vote. So,
okay. Is it time for a bottle deposit law here in New Hampshire?
You know, I don't know that that would change anything. I mean, it might curtail a little bit people throwing cans and bottles out the window, but there's an extra cost of handling. And, you know, until recently when, you know, the market got upended by China's, you know, reluctance to take recyclables, we're doing a pretty good job of recycling in New Hampshire. So I don't think a bottle law changes that. It certainly adds, you know, a lot of cost and extra aggravation to all of us as consumers. I think, you know, I every week or every second week, you know, go up to the transfer station. I love it up there. They're really great guys in Wolfboro, and they do a really good job. They're incredibly helpful to everybody, and it's not an easy job, as you might imagine. But our transfer station in Wolfboro is well-run, well-managed, good people, and they do a really good job of, you know, recycling glass, batteries, cans, aluminum cans, paper, cardboard, and now plastics, thankfully, have been returned for recycling. So my sense is, Eric, people, you know, will recycle if you make it easy for them. And I think the point of why I'm giving, you know, our folks at the transfer station such a shout out is they've done an excellent job of making it easy for people.
Yeah, the town I lived in tried it for a while, and then when the bottom fell out of the recyclables market, they stopped. But it was amazing how much of your trash is recyclable.
It is rather amazing. I agree.
I'd say at least half of
yeah,
everything we throw
away. Yeah, I would say that. I mean, all paper, all cardboard, you know, cans and bottles, plastics, all recyclable. And honestly, that's, you know, at least half, if not more, of our trash. We need to be encouraging that. And I think, you know, having it's called a materials recovery facility, otherwise in the parlance of the legislature, a MRF.
Well, which brings up an interesting point. Even if we had a bottle law, what happens to the recyclable? What happens to the cans and bottles?
So, you to get a refund, you would have to take your disposed bottles to a place where you get a refund. So it's
right.
Sort of an extra stock.
Right.
And that, to me, that makes it more difficult. There's a, you know, we've had this debate in the past, and, you know, a long time ago, I was on a committee that looked at this, I mean, 20-plus years ago, and I think the thing that we came to the conclusion of, we toured a couple of places in Maine that had it, and it was kind of messy, and there was a sanitation issue because you were taking it to a separate, you know, we went to a separate facility, and I think it's difficult. That, you know, a lot of people probably would just toss the stuff in the recyclables the way they normally do. So then there's an added cost of a nickel or a dime per bottle. Now, what some towns have done is you take your cans to, a container, and they get the money for it somehow. And so it's like a donation, but still. I think New Hampshire has done a pretty good job of recycling, especially given that we don't have one of these MRF facilities. Yeah, I think if we had a MRF facility, that would definitely be an improvement for recycling, because it would cut down the cost. And, you know, the trucks are a way of life, but, you know, I think I read in the application it would be the equivalent, just taking the recyclables down to Billerica, Mass. If we weren't doing that in New Hampshire, taking about 30,000 cars off the highway.
Really?
That's a lot of, yeah, oh yeah. So there, you know, it's one of those cost-benefit, you know, analysis that you have to do. And pro-environment on one side and pro-environment on the other side. So I think that, there's been some discussion about there was a faulty valve at the Casella facility in Bethlehem recently. But the way it was engineered, my understanding is the water discharge that happened was all caught in the retention areas and nothing escaped. So these things are state-of-the-art. They should be state-of-the-art. They should be, you know, fail-safe as much as humanly possible, engineered, to make sure that there's better than ample protection, you know, for groundwater and siteliness. So there needs to be good buffers. I totally agree with that.
And people have to understand that they do need to go someplace.
Well, that's the point. And, you know, I mean, I remember when I was a kid, you don't see it as much today. But, when I was a kid, my parents bought their house in the 1950s. And I remember rummaging around on the back 40. And, you know, there were a couple of areas where, you know, the prior owners had just deposited stuff. And then we banned, I think this was 20 years ago, the burning of, you know, certain kinds of trash in a, you know, burn pile, you know, on the back 40 again, because of the emissions of toxins and things like that. And if you make it so expensive that, whether it's through your tipping fees or, a bag and tag program that some communities have, people look for avoidance measures, and that's not good for the environment either.
No, it's not, and you're right. If, you know, I like the pay by the bag, but as you say, there are.
If it's a dollar a bag, I think most people don't grouse too much. But what happens if it becomes $5 a bag or $10 a bag?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if that ever happens, but if the tipping fees go up and up and up and towns are trying to recoup their money because of, you know, they're trying to minimize the impact on taxpayers, then it could. So, and then you get into, you know, every individual starts doing their own cost-benefit analysis.
Right. Anyway. It's 12:21 here in WASR. We're talking with Senate Majority Leader in Concord, Jeb Bradley. Question. Senate President Morris said that he didn't expect to start spending the federal stimulus money until later this summer. Why? Does it take that long for the money?
First of all, we haven't gotten it. Okay.
Right. That's what I mean. We haven't gotten it yet.
We haven't gotten it. That's first of all. Second, and I believe that in a couple of weeks there's going to be a proposal that goes before, you know, the fiscal committee that for the first tranche of the money that we would accept it and then distribute it to, different entities in New Hampshire that would be able to, you know, start utilizing that money. So whether it's, you know, the Parks Department, whether it's water infrastructure projects, potentially broadband and transportation, or, you know, other that you'd consider more capital-type projects, IT-type things. Dam repair is another one that we're looking at. We're trying to, you know, look for one-time capital infrastructure projects that, you know, make sense. And, you know, lining that up in a rational way is, you can't just, you know, throw seedlings in the ground, right, or else you're going to get a lot of waste. And I think, you know, that's where Senator Morse's comments came from. But this money will get out there at the same time. So it will happen. Another one, you know, that I think we're going to look to help, provide help to, is affordable housing. I mean, that's a big issue in New Hampshire. You know, and people are, businesses are, like, clamoring for more people to come back to work. And it's not just the, you know, federal unemployment extra benefit that's keeping people home. It's a range of things. But affordable housing, to be able to encourage people to live in New Hampshire, because a lot of people want to come here for various reasons. It's a great state to live in, work in, play in. But you also have to be able to afford to be here. And so that's another opportunity to provide, you know, funding into what's called the Affordable Housing Fund that helps have developers get better access to capital, lower cost capital, and, you know, some of it's revolving loans, sometimes grants, but, you know, there's Harriman Hill in Wolfboro was assisted by the Affordable Housing Fund. Conway Pines and Conway, same thing. So I think most people, you know, understand the need for, you know, workforce housing, and got to have it. And it's really important to our state. So these are the types of things that, you know, we're looking at use of the money for. But you think, oh, geez, $1 billion, have a party and spend it all. If you want to be smart about it, because it is taxpayer money, and our kids are going to have to pay it back, for better or worse, you know, and you're probably starting to see some of the impacts of all the federal money sloshing around through the economy. It's called inflation. And, you know, we're starting to see supply chain issues now, especially in construction. So our goal is, and I think it starts with the governor on down, don't use this money to grow government programs, okay? Use it to do infrastructure that will be enduring for the future. So upgrades in our state parks, I mean, to me, that's a priority.
Sure. But does it always take this long for the federal government to write the check, as it were?
That is a good question. I think that, you know, last year, right around this time, you know, we were, I think even earlier, the CARES Act passed in the end of March in Congress, and that's what created the Payroll Protection Program, and that was up and going within 2 or 3 weeks, as I recall. You know, we have a different administration now, and we'll just leave it there.
Okay. 1226, hello there. Last week, we talked a little bit about people being kept involuntarily in emergency rooms.
Yeah.
If you remember. Now, the state Supreme Court has just said that the three-day clock starts in the emergency room, not at where we're currently starting the clock when they get out of the emergency room. How does that make things harder for mental health providers?
It's going to make it more difficult. And again, as I think I said last week, probably the right decision by the, you know, Supreme Court. I can't say I argue with that. People that are held involuntarily do have a habeas corpus right to a hearing before a judge. Facilitating that has proven, you know, to be difficult. So the mental health crisis that we have in New Hampshire has been dramatically exacerbated by the pandemic. I mean, we have dedicated over the last 3 or 4 years huge new resources for mental health. We have built more what are called receiving beds. So, you know, beds in hospitals that specifically accept mental health patients. So they don't have to be in the ER. They can go to one of these designated receiving beds. Okay. We have increased the number of beds at the New Hampshire hospital. We've enhanced what's known as transitional housing. So the people, if they get admitted to the hospital, the New Hampshire hospital, or one of these receiving beds, as their condition starts to improve, but they're not ready, you know, to go back and be on their own, they have transitional housing. So, you know, there's been a huge amount of new resources dedicated to mental health. But then the pandemic hit, and, you know, we had really pretty much eliminated the emergency boarding problems, but now they're back in full swing because so many more people are impacted adversely, you know, because we've been cooped up for a year, and it just, it has an impact on people's, you know, ability to cope with the lockdown restrictions and the not seeing their friends and socializing, you know, working from home, isolation, you know, potential substance abuse issues. So that's all, you know, been a huge problem that's been exacerbated by the pandemic. And at the same time, the Department of Health and Human Services has had to deal with the public health implications of the pandemic. And so some of the resources that we have made available for mental health funding to create better opportunities for in-home care or, you know, more of the transitional beds, they had to put on the back burner because they were dealing with the public health crisis of the pandemic. So we're, you know, coming through the end of that, and I think you're going to see of these federal dollars a significant amount of, you know, additional resources dedicated to mental health, you know, in the Senate version of the budget that we're going to be voting on in 2 weeks. So, you know, just having participated in those discussions, I know it's, you know, happening as well it should. I mean, it's a crisis, and it's been, you know, made far worse by the pandemic. And because, you know, it's a pandemic-related issue, we're able to have pretty good flexibility with the federal funds that are coming into New Hampshire, that it won't be restricted for the use for mental health. It'll be a good use.
Well, let me ask you this, Senator. And I agree with you completely that the mental health crisis here in New Hampshire isn't getting any better. And yes, the pandemic has exacerbated it quite a bit. To that end, we've already acknowledged that being cooped up is not good for the old brain cells. Why then do we keep prisoners in solitary confinement?
Well,
you know, we know it's harmful, or are learning it's harmful.
Yeah. No, and look, I think that I'm not a corrections expert by any means. So my understanding generally of solitary confinement is, you know, obviously we have the supermax prisons run by the feds, and so sometimes, you know, some of the most dangerous people are held in solitary. But generally speaking, in our state prison system or possibly even county, it is, you know, people are held in solitary confinement when there is a discipline issue, is my understanding. And, you know, obviously you want to minimize that so that, you know, hopefully prison is about not just somebody paying their debt to society, so to speak, but preparing that individual when his or her, you know, so-called debt or prison time is up, that they're able to reintegrate back into society.
Okay. It is 12:32 here on WASR, 569-5253, if you'd like to ask the senator a question. Let's talk about some of the bills that have come through, most of them you're familiar with. Senate Bill 24 especially, which had to do with increasing the size of Brewster Academy's board. And as I read the bill yesterday, I went, well, why do we need an act of state law to enlarge their board?
Well, a long story. When Brewster was originally chartered, it had a charter from the New Hampshire legislature. And so in order for them to increase their board, they had to have a charter amendment. But what Senate Bill 24 also did, appropriately so, is put Brewster in charge of their own operations and not have to, you know, come back to the legislature for making these kind of changes. So the folks at Brewster had approached me 2 years ago about sponsoring this bill. It got caught up in the pandemic, you know, when so many bills ended up on the table last year, and it didn't go through. So they asked me to refile it. I did not do. You know, I think it's probably on its way to the governor's desk, if not signed already.
Yeah, I understood that it did pass relatively easily.
There was no opposition to it. It makes sense that they don't need to ask permission to do things.
I also understand that there have been some changes to campaign finance rules, or proposed changes, I should say. The Municipal Affairs Committee passed a bill raising contribution limits.
Yeah. In New Hampshire, we have a somewhat different standard than the feds, and it's kind of arcane. Before you're an announced candidate, you can receive $5,000 from an individual, a business, a political action committee, and then $1,000 for a primary and $1,000 for a general election. So the, you know, proposal was an amendment to that.
Okay. So how then, or does this happen more on the federal level? Do the big lobbying groups, AARP, the NRA, and so many others, how are they giving millions of dollars?
So the way the feds, you know, do this, I believe the limit now is $2,800 from an individual. So, and it can be primary or general election. So an individual can donate, you know, to a congressional candidate, for instance, I think $5,600. A spouse can do the same. Obviously, it's per individual. And then a political action committee can donate $5,000. But what happens, and where all the talk of millions comes in, are independent expenditures. And so, you know, if a third-party, unaffiliated, but like-minded group, you know, wants to say, you know, person X is doing a great job and, you know, we support that person, it's unlimited what they can spend money on. And that's why, you know, when you see a U.S. Senate race, for instance, they're always, you know, high expenditure affairs when it's a fairly close race. And so the individual candidate themselves might be able to raise, you know, $5 million, say. And you know, in a state like New Hampshire, $5 million goes a long way. In California, it'd be obviously more because it's so much bigger. But in a state like New Hampshire, $5 million goes a long ways. But, you know, when you get saturation ads on, you know, Channel 4, Channel 5, Channel 7, all the cable networks, Channel 13, Channel 10 in Vermont, that mounts up pretty quickly. But that's what these independent expenditures target. And so that's how it, that's how on a federal race it's financed. Obviously in state races you can have independent expenditures. It generally speaking is a lot less. I mean, for instance, state Senate races are nowhere near as expensive as a congressional race or a U.S. Senate race, but they still can get, they still can get pricey for a $100 a year job. But there are a lot of ways that people can interact or contact voters that it's not TV. Radio is a good medium. Direct mail is another good medium. More and more advertising is being done online on Facebook, you know, that kind of situation. That's a lot, you know, more cost effective. So at any rate, I'm not a big supporter of public financing of campaigns. I think people should have to, you know, raise money. And I don't think your taxpayer dollars should be funding candidates.
No, I agree with you. I mean, we all know the little checkbox on our tax forms. And I'm proud to say that in my entire life, I have never checked off that form to donate money to the campaign fund. What is it now? $3, I think?
I have no idea. I think. I've never checked it off either.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. But there is, but there are people that do, and there is limited public funding for elections, for federal elections.
And look, I think it's a good idea. I think it, not to have public financing. I think there, you know, enough controversial things that, you know, whether it's state government or feds fund, that taxpayers should not be funding people that represent them.
All right, let's move on. The lot of discussion around the so-called divisive concepts bill, Senate Bill 96. And you said that was one of yours, so you know all about it. What's wrong with the schools discussing the issues and having the students make their own decisions on the, on these divisive concepts?
Well, I think there's a difference, Eric, between you know, anti-bias training, discussing you know, racism or bigotry or homophobia or any of those types of things. There's a huge difference between discussing it to make sure that none of us have bias and that we are, as the law says we must be in the United States, equal under the law according to the 14th Amendment, and a format that basically says, you know, one race, one religion, one sex is somehow superior to another or inferior to another, or by virtue of, you know, the immutable characteristics that you're born with, you're oppressive or you're, you know, on the other hand, potentially oppressed. I don't think that, you know, under the 14th Amendment and equality under the law and, you know, the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and all the rights that we have, you know, under the U.S. Constitution, that, you know, the teaching, if you will, of racial superiority or inferiority or one race is an oppressor, that, to me, that goes a little bit too far. And I think that, you know, starts to touch on discrimination, really. So I think what you're going to see the Senate do is winnow down that language to make sure that things like I just highlighted, that one race is not superior to the other and there should not be government teaching to the fact that, you know, if in a school or a government training program that they are teaching or advocating racial superiority, I think that's where it becomes a problem. So, you know, I think you'll see that proposal by the end of next week. And I think most people are going to think it makes sense, actually.
Have you heard from people who are for the bill? And
oh,
what
yeah.
do they say?
I
what
have
do they
heard
say?
From people. I have heard from people that are for the bill, and I have heard from people that are against the bill. 544.
What are some of the arguments? Go ahead.
When I've outlined where I think the Senate is going to go, I haven't had anybody disagree with me, quite frankly.
Hmm. What are the people that are for the bill basing their arguments on?
I think they believe, quite frankly, with some justification, that some of the writings and teachings of, you know, what's known as critical race theory institute sort of a reverse discrimination approach to, you know, life. And I think that's the concern. So I think it's a legit concern. I think you've seen it play out in local elections around the country. Certainly, you know, what happened in Texas or in Virginia in local elections. I think people are very concerned about that. What we're trying to do is find, you know, a spot where we can say, look, when you are advocating for, you know, racial superiority, that's a problem. That's discrimination. As opposed to saying, as some people interpreted, you know, the legislation that was in the House banning, you know, diversity training, that also is a problem. And so I think, you know, when you see the Senate proposal, you'll see that, you know, we certainly are going to make it very clear that nothing is going to restrict, nor should it, you know, diversity training or anti-bias training. I think, you know, that's a really important component in life today. And I think we all need to be aware of, you know, how people react to things, and we can all learn from those things. And so anti-bias training should be encouraged.
Okay. Unfortunately, it becomes rapidly a political decision. And I think that's where you start to have a problem. The only thing I could think of is you know, you present both sides and the student makes their own decision. But
and again, I think that when you see the Senate proposal, there'll be nothing that's going to restrict a school or, you know, a government program from talking about sensitive issues that need to be talked about. But you know, a lot of times when things go too far, they go too far. And I think that's what we're trying to prevent.
Well, who decides what's too far? Is that what's in the bill?
Yes, there would be those, as I said, you know, when you're labeling somebody an oppressor by virtue of their immutable characteristics, or advocating for policies that, you know, call someone with immutable characteristics superior or inferior, yeah, I think that's a problem. And the proposal that I think you'll see coming from the Senate is going to outline that.
All right. It is 12:46. Let's take a call, see what's going on. Hi, you're on WASR. Hello.
Thank you for calling WASR.
Oh, I guess they're not. I hung up. Okay. All right, we're back with Senator Bradley. And one of the things that we talked about, I believe, recently, might have been last week, Senate Bill 92, about some changes and some common sense language about bail violations. Can you kind of give us the highlights on that?
Yeah, so this is one that I'm actually pretty disappointed where it looks like we're going to end up. I introduced Senate Bill 92, working with the chiefs of police and victims advocates, that would have required for certain crimes, generally felony level, like murder, manslaughter, kidnapping, human trafficking, pornography, felonious sexual assault, and domestic violence. that instead of, you know, somebody getting personal recognizance or PR bail, that they could be held, if it was a violent type crime, for up to 3 days and get a hearing in front of a judge before getting bail. What's happening right now is that under bail reform laws that were passed a couple of years ago, which, by the way, I supported because we were told that it was going to make sure that lower income people had the same access to bail that more affluent people had. And I thought that made sense. But the way it's been implemented and interpreted, basically, unless it's the most egregious of situation, people are getting PR bail. And so we have had many examples, and there was one in Nashua not that long ago where there was a domestic violence incident. It was violent. The person was arrested, got PR bail, went back to the home, and proceeded to rape and, you know, beat the victim that he had been arrested for a domestic violence incident, you know, within the 24-hour period. There have been other examples. That's not just a lone example. And so I think if you talk to, and I've spent a lot of time talking about this to Chief Shigori from Tuftonboro or Chief Rondo or any of the other chiefs, Obecki and Hollis or Brodsonski in Bedford, they've seen it firsthand that it's almost become a revolving door. And, you know, in these violent situations, it seems to me that to protect victims, and that's the whole point, is not allowing victimization, especially in domestic violence situations, which are the majority of those, you know, incidents, that it should be in front of a judge as opposed to virtually automatically being released. Well, unfortunately, our friends in the House didn't see it that way. The American Civil Liberties Union was adamant against the bill. I mean, this is, you know, the same thing that's happened in other states. I think our law is not as bad as it is, our current law that I'm trying to fix, not as bad as it is in other states. But certainly, you know, we saw example after example of people, especially in New York, that, you know, were being arrested many, many times and out on the street within hours again. And so I'm trying to fix that. The ACLU opposed that, and there were some other objections from judges that said, you know, they were going to be overworked, that they needed more judges, that they were going to have hearings. And so the House committee decided to retain the bill and work on it, you know, over the next 6 months. I'm not happy about it, but I'm not sure that there is a, you know, way forward in the next 3 weeks, 4 weeks before the end of the legislative session. So
one of the things I liked about the bill is that they once you miss a court date, there's a rebuttable presumption that you don't enjoy had you not done that. In other words, you've done it once, you know, how do we know you're not going to do it again? And then
what's happening now, because of the bail reform, people are just getting released, reoffending, or getting released, and they're supposed to show up for a court date, and they never show up because there's just no consequences. So another piece of that bill, you do that three times, you don't show up for your court appointment, and you're subject to arrest and detention if you haven't shown up three times. And people are just thumbing their nose at, you know, some pretty serious violent level, felony level, not all felony, there are some misdemeanors thrown in there too, level crimes. But, you know, a Class B misdemeanor is subject to a year in jail. So it's, you know, these are serious crimes. And I tried to make it pretty narrow You know, I listed the crimes before: murder, manslaughter, kidnapping, pornography, domestic violence, felonious sexual assault. You know, fairly narrow range of crimes that included victims, direct victims. But I, to tell you the truth, I'm shocked that it didn't go forward.
Hmm. You know, I was really wondering about that bill. I believe, if I remember right, it also increases the penalties for criminal mischief. And I was reading the bill, and as of now, criminal mischief is a violation. Somebody could paint swastikas on my car, and they get a ticket?
Yep. And that somehow slid through a couple of years ago. I don't know how it happened. There wasn't, you know, a lot of scrutiny about it. I think the law a couple of years ago was hard to enforce, and so the penalty was dropped from a misdemeanor to a violation. So the first part of that bill, you know, if you're somebody with criminal intent and you're creating, you know, a problem that is over, like, you know, graffiti or defacing public property or anything like that, that is, the value of the crime that you've committed is over $1,000, then it goes back to being a misdemeanor as opposed to a violation, which seemed like a pretty good compromise to me. But again, the, you know, my friends in the House just did not go along with it.
So the bill is pretty much in limbo at this point.
Well, there's a process. They, in the Senate, we call it refer for study in the first year session. In the House, the committee actually retains it. So either way, it's the same outcome. The bill stays in the committee from the first session to the second session. So the first session, first year, is almost over. It'll be over June 24th. What is that? A month from today. But then, you know, probably after a two-month break, committees start coming back in September, October, November time frame. A lot less, because we're not in session, but committees will do their work. They'll dig into bills deeply, and we haven't had as much time as we would have liked, you know, this, you know, winter and spring, just because of the volume of bills. So a bill like this is going to get a lot of scrutiny. And, you know, I've worked with the chairman of the committee, Representative Abbas, who's a really good guy, tried very hard to, you know, get this through. But, you know, it was a partisan bill, make no bones about it. And, you know, it was, the House makeup is very, very closely aligned on a partisan basis, and he didn't have the votes to get it through, and so the only course of action was to hold it over.
Okay, so basically he's just...
So we'll come back in January, and right. Quite frankly, I'm reintroducing the same bill in the Senate again, so it'll be... And it will be a bigger bill. I just, with all the things that are happening now with the budget and all the other bills, I'm not sure, especially with the judges complaining that they need 6 new judges to implement this, which I dispute, but, you know, that's what they're saying. It just seems more realistic to let the House take their time with it, hopefully come up with something workable. That being said, I'm not dropping it. And, you know, as I said, I'm pretty upset because I think, you know, to me, safe streets, safe homes, safe schools, kind of a top priority along with, you know, jobs and paychecks for people. So I think we've seen too many examples in other states of how bail reform, you know, is pro-criminal and not working in terms of safety.
It is 12:57 here on WASR. It's a beautiful Friday. So the Mega Millions jackpot, $515 million. You going to buy a ticket?
Well, I glad you told me. Maybe I'll have to go down to the corner store and buy a ticket.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, you're buying some nice daydreams. You know,
yeah,
they
well,
always...
knowing me, I'd file it away in some pocket and wash the pants. And
you know, I could see that. I my wife would do that because she washes things all the time. It's a good thing driver's licenses are plastic because it's been washed at
there
least four
go.
Times. But
well,
anyway.
I used to have a, what is it called, an iPod, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one day after a hike, I just came home. I was exhausted. I threw all the clothes in the washing machine, and I washed my iPod. Of course, I destroyed it,
too. Oh, yeah, that'll do it. I still have mine, actually.
I have it, too.
There's a guy on eBay who actually replaces batteries in them.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, well, because mine's like 10 years old at this point. The battery was shot. And I was like, It's interesting to be able to hold your entire record collection in the palm of your hand.
I know. It's pretty amazing.
That's the amazing part of it. Anyway, thank you very much, Senator. I hope you have
a
fantastic weekend. I don't know if you've looked out the window, but...
It's gorgeous.
And the pollen is falling like snow.
I know.
It's unbelievable. I don't think I've ever seen this.
Yeah, well, it's been dry for a while. So we had a couple of weeks ago quite a bit of rain, but none for a couple of weeks. And so the pollen's pretty extreme.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to spend some time in the garden. So
good.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Well, Senator, thank you very much for your time, and we'll talk next week. In the meantime,
all right.
Enjoy your weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Take
and
care.
To your listeners.
All right.
Thanks.
Enjoy. Bye. It is 12:59 here in WASR. Thank you very much for listening. Yeah, $515 million in megabucks. I don't know what the lump sum of that is. Probably somewhere in the upper twos, low threes, $100 million. You know, I always say the lottery ruins your life. I would love the chance for it to try. I really would. 1 o'clock news is next.